Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, a dam collapse in Sudan has led to dozens of deaths. So we're exploring the reasons why dams are considered to be installations containing dangerous forces under international law.
The danger with dams is that they store huge quantities of water. And downstream, you have lots of people who are farming, they're irrigating. Now, if that dam is to breach, it is going to discharge a tsunami of water, which will literally wipe out anybody anywhere near the river.
Also, as Dr. Ganeyat Popola spends yet another day in captivity in Nigeria, she was abducted in December, we're asking why so many doctors are being kidnapped across the country.
In the last 1 month, there was the case of the kidnap of the doctor in Anambra. There was a kidnap of the doctor in Akwa Ibom, the doctor in Kogi State. There were two cases of kidnaps of doctors within Abuja and medical intern along with some medical students in Benue State. The medical professionals are seen as soft targets. Also, they are being used as healthcare providers within the den of the kidnappers.
It's Monday, the 2nd of September. First, we go to the Horn of Africa. Ethiopia and Somalia are at odds once again. They've been quarreling over Ethiopia establishing a relationship with Somaliland, which would allow the landlocked country access to the sea. Somalia is not happy with that arrangement because Hargeisa is a breakaway region and therefore not mandated to make international agreements. Things moved up a notch when Egyptian military planes entered the fray at the invitation of Mogadishu. The planes were delivering weapons, ammunition and military personnel to Somalia. Cairo and Addis Ababa have been at loggerheads for years over the construction of a huge dam on the River Nile. And Ethiopia's deal for access to the sea with Somaliland goes further than just access. Addis signed a deal with the self-declared Republic of Somaliland to lease a coastal area to build a naval base. Dr. Hassan Kenenje is the director of the Horn International Institute for Strategic Studies. He's been describing the tensions between these countries in greater detail.
I think the row emanates from the decision by Somalia to invite, you know, Egyptians to be part of not just the theater in terms of peacekeeping, but getting into some, you know, bilateral military arrangements and security arrangements with Somalia, which is viewed in Addis Ababa as a threat to its interests, not just because of the dispute between Addis Ababa and Cairo over the Great Renaissance Dam, but because of also Addis Ababa's desire to have freedom of action in certain parts of Somalia, which it has always had that kind of leeway.
It seems like Ethiopia is involved in very major spats with its neighbors at the moment. Just tell us why it would regard Egypt as a threat. And I thought that the Renaissance Dam was an ongoing discussion rather than a constant point of friction.
The Renaissance Dam, it is a vital, you know, strategic investment for Addis Ababa with regard to its ability to contribute to its fast-growing economy and be able to light up its population. But there's also another issue where Ethiopia gets concerned. Ethiopia is still a landlocked country, and its access to sea is critical to its survival. And so it sees the current maneuvers, especially from the military perspective, as potentially threatening to harm its access. Remember, the cause of the tension, that's, you know, the MOU that was signed between Addis Ababa and Hargeisa, which is a breakaway region of Somalia, was in part meant to guarantee that access. Right now, most of it, you know, sea trade, you know, is still going through the port of Djibouti. And in recent months, you know, they have tried to get things through the ports of Lamu in Kenya. But to the extent that the current strategic arrangements between Mogadishu and Cairo may threaten that access, both in Djibouti as well as in Somalia, of course, it's going to be interpreted as a matter of national survival and national security.
So this is not just a matter of sort of diplomatic tit for tat. Is Somalia in a way punishing or warning Ethiopia about its connection with Somaliland by inviting Egypt in?
There was a statement from Mogadishu saying that, well, that Addis Ababa is harvesting what they sow. And I think that was in reference to the kind of agreements that they signed with the breakaway region, which still Mogadishu is keen not to have Somaliland recognized as an independent entity. And so, yeah, in a way, it is a punishment, but also in a way, I think because Somalia's own naval forces, as well as military, do not have the capacity to man their own waters and guarantee their own security. So it's also, I think, from Mogadishu's perspective, an insurance policy against any future encroachments, you know, by either neighboring countries or foreign entities.
Egypt hasn't, until quite recently, shown much interest in Africa further south of the Sahara. Is this a major point of them re-entering the continent in that way?
Actually, Egypt has been showing increasing interest in recent years. If you pay attention, especially the countries in the Horn of Africa, they've been pretty quick in trying to, you know, sign some kind of military agreements with regard to cooperation agreements, exchange of notes and stuff like that within the countries in East Africa. And this, I think, is just an expansion, or rather a dramatic expansion of that kind of interest. And ever since, of course, the dispute with Ethiopia started over the dam, Egypt considers the Nile as a critical, you know, survival asset, you know, historically. Even though, of course, countries like Ethiopia and countries in eastern part of Africa think the treaties that were signed in 2959 were not exactly fair. And so this is a dramatic expansion. It is not new, but is an ongoing trend that we have seen, not just coming from Egypt, but a number of countries in the Gulf as well as the Middle East.
Could it spill over into a regional war? Because people are warning that this is quite serious, and it's underpinned in your analysis as well.
I do not think it will spill into open warfare. It may see limited conflagrations between forces, especially, you know, if Egypt moves ahead to deploy its forces in Somalia, and especially in sectors where I think Ethiopia or Addis Ababa considers to be strategic national security and national interest. But an all-out, you know, war, I doubt if both parties are actually invested in trying to see that, because if that happens, Egypt also has a lot to lose with regard to the way it's perceived within the sub-Saharan Africa, if it were to move its, you know, troops to actually start, you know, fighting with Ethiopia. Now, Ethiopia right now, neither does it have the capacity to be able to take on Egypt. Egypt has a very powerful military in terms of you know, a full interstate conflict. And so you may see limited conflagrations across the border and or in sectors. If in fact, you know, Egypt moves ahead and makes those deployments, and if Ethiopia, for instance, resists the call by Somalia, you know, to withdraw from some of those sectors, remember, a chunk of Ethiopian presence in Somalia, they're still not exactly under AMISOM. So even beyond the expiration of AMISOM term, by December of this year, there's a likelihood you're still going to have a presence of Ethiopian troops inside Somalia.
Are there attempts ongoing to resolve this particular spat or row between these three countries?
Yes, there have been attempts both by, you know, regionally as well as individual countries in East Africa as well as the African Union. What is hoped for is that some of these efforts are going to bear fruit. Right now, though, in the absence of really united and concerted efforts beyond the continent, because a number of these countries are also being supported by others, you know, elsewhere, I think it's going to be, you know, difficult. You know, we expect that both the African Union and the United Nations, as well as key actors in the world, can bring pressure to bear and also persuade the parties right now that there is a potential for escalation that is going to have catastrophic consequences for the region and for the countries involved. And so that need has to be treated with urgency. If we don't move in that direction and the different efforts work in silos, it's going to be very difficult to reach a consensus.
Djibouti's foreign minister told the BBC that it is offering one of its ports to Ethiopia to access the Red Sea because Ethiopia desperately wants access to the Red Sea. Could this resolve the crisis?
In part, that may resolve the crisis. Addis Ababa, I think they are keen not to become victim of tokenism. I think they want certain guarantee with regard to the access to the sea. That may help. But again, that has to be done within some kind of international arrangement, international framework, way it's understood, so that that offer cannot be taken off the table at the convenience of the Djiboutian government or the Djiboutian parliament. So that is going to relieve some pressure. But it may not also solve the fundamental challenges that Ethiopia has to transport, you know, its goods, far field, to get to the port of Djibouti.
Yeah, because that was an offer that was made before, and Ethiopia felt that it wasn't sufficient. So what do you think will happen next?
What's likely to happen next here? We're still going to see some tensions, but I think there is an emerging consensus that the current escalation is not sustainable. And what we expect is we're going to perhaps, start hearing more from the African Union perspective, because you're having two countries that are important players on the continent that potentially plunge the region into a conflict. And so we expect to see a lot more robust engagement and noise coming from the African Union, as well as voice from the United Nations to, with regard to international peace and security or the threat that's being caused because of these tensions. They will probably not escalate beyond manageable levels, but that escalation risk, still there.
Dr. Hassan Kanenje, director of the Horn International Institute for Strategic Studies. The people of Sudan have had a civil war raging through the country for the last 16 months. They face violence, rape, and hunger as the Sudanese army fights it out with a faction, the Rapid Support Forces. Diplomatic interventions have yet to bear fruit. And now the people have the weather to deal with as well. Torrential rains and floods have killed dozens of them and forced tens of thousands of others from their homes. Those rains have led to a dam burst, and the death toll is rising. The dam was the main source of drinking water for the coastal city of Port Sudan, where the military government is based. But Sudan is not the only country where this has happened. It happened in Libya and also in Kenya. Dams are crucial for development. They provide irrigation and electricity. They are also regarded as installations containing dangerous forces under international humanitarian law because of the danger an overflowing or damaged dam poses to civilian populations. So let's talk about dams and dam failures with Dr. Sean Avery, an expert in African hydrology, focusing on sustainable water management and environmental impact. We started with what could have caused the dam burst in Sudan.
Preliminary findings I've seen reported were heavy rains and a dam breach resulting in it completely emptying. Now, that immediately suggests to me that the spillway capacity was inadequate and the dam overtopped, or the spillway had structural problems, collapsed and caused a breach there. I do know from research which I've done that this dam was subject to very heavy siltation. In other words, a lot of sediment accumulation within the reservoir. Although the dam was built in 2003, in 2021, 70% of the dam was full of sediment.
Tell me about spillway quickly.
Basically, every dam is designed so that if the dam fills up and you get a flood coming into it, you have a structure which carries that flood water safely downstream without damaging the dam itself. So that means that that structure has got to be big enough to cope with the big floods. And under normal design criteria, that would be a very severe flood, potentially the flood which occurs once in 10,000 years. I can just elaborate on that. One of the things that we are seeing in Africa is considerable, because of the human population pressures increasing, we are seeing floods actually increasing in size. Now, what that means is that you're getting much bigger floods coming into these reservoirs. And the other thing which has happened in the case of this particular reservoir is that it's like a bathtub. If that bathtub is empty when the flood comes in, it has lots of capacity to fill up before it starts to spill. But in the case of this dam, its bathtub is 70% already full of sediment. That means you've only got 30% left to fill before it starts to spill. What it means is that in the case of this dam, The flood buffer capacity that one would normally have in a large reservoir was compromised by the fact that it was full of sediment.
It's not the first time that a dam has burst on the continent. Kenya, 45 people were killed when a makeshift dam burst, and then in Libya last year as well, and I'm sure there are other dams that have collapsed. Do any of these dams have anything in common as the reason for why they burst?
These big dams have quite sophisticated procedures for monitoring after they're built. These monitoring procedures are designed to pick up warning signs of a problem that could lead to a catastrophic failure. Now, one thing that these two dams that you mentioned, well, the one in Libya and the one in Sudan, have got in common, and I have actually seen the same here in Kenya, to be honest, is that they're in conflict zones. And if there's a conflict zone, then the sort of normal measures for monitoring become compromised, because the people who are actually responsible for that don't have the freedom to move around these areas, and they don't have the support from government. And one of the problems we have in Africa is bureaucracy. It is also a lack of capacity. And also, in the case of a dam maintenance, often there's no budget allocated for that. So when something crops up like this, we end up in a bureaucratic muddle trying to get technical resources to look into it, and so on and so forth. So the whole process gets delayed.
So that's maintenance and essentially governance. Is there also an element of intentional sabotage in some dams collapsing?
Yes, it can happen, but I've never actually personally seen evidence of that. I mean, these are major structures, and it would be quite difficult to do. Certainly in my experience here in Kenya, structures like this are quite heavily guarded.
Now, a lot of the dams and the damage to dams, we've been talking about rainfall, and given that climate change is happening and El Nino is a major player in the way in which the climate is shifting, I'm just wondering whether we're going to see more dam collapses because of that.
Climate change is a fact, and it does mean that rainfall patterns are changing. But actually, if you look at the rainfall records, the amount of rainfall has not changed that dramatically. And I feel that the biggest issue from a hydrological point of view is that the amount of water that's running off these days from a unit of rainfall is much higher than it was 40 years ago. And that's not because of climate change, that's because of the degradation of catchments. Rivers in Africa are sort of sources of water, and people tend to gravitate towards those rivers. Now, we have got laws in Kenya that forbid any cultivation within the riverbanks or the riparian zone of a river, but that legislation is not enforced. And as a result of that, you're losing the sort of buffer zone that actually smooths out floods as the water runs off the catchment and into the river. And those buffer zones also hold back the sediment. So what the big factor I have seen throughout Africa, and I've been doing this for 40 years, is catchment degradation is the big factor that we've got to factor in.
So now, catchment degradation, just to be clear, tell us again what it is in language that we can understand.
Okay. Well, catchment degradation in an extreme case would be where we've chopped down the entire forest cover in a catchment.
And the catchment is around the river, along the banks and so on?
Yes, it is. If you imagine a river flowing into a dam, that river is draining an area of land which we call the catchment. And that river has a network of tributaries which actually collect the water from the catchment. If you want to actually control floods, you want that land surface to be well covered with vegetation, which binds the soils and slows down rainfalls. Instead of disappearing into the nearest river, it soaks into the ground. And unfortunately, with land degradation, that's not happening.
Dams are considered installations containing dangerous forces under international humanitarian law. Just explain to us why that is the case.
The danger with dams is that they store huge quantities of water. And downstream on the watercourses, you have lots of people who are farming, they're irrigating. Now, if that dam is to breach, it is going to discharge catastrophic, like a tsunami of water downstream, which will literally wipe out anybody anywhere near the river. dams, they have a huge risk factor. And as a result of that, there are very few people in the world or companies in the world who are qualified to design and supervise construction of dams like this, because when they fail, it is catastrophic and it's all the way downstream.
Dr. Sean Avery, an expert in hydrology and sustainable water management. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service. Now imagine being a doctor tasked with saving lives, but fearing for your own, not being able to practice in peace, fearing that a band of kidnappers will take you and hold you ransom. That day came last December for Dr. Ganiat Popola, an ophthalmologist and mother of five, who was kidnapped late last year along with her husband and her nephew in Nigeria. Dr. Popola's husband was released in March after a ransom was paid, but both her and her nephew still remain in captivity. Growing numbers of doctors are so fearful in Nigeria, it's one of the main reasons they cite for wanting to leave the country. Doctors in public hospitals have just ended a nationwide strike to demand the release of their colleague. The president of the Nigerian Doctors Association, Dr. Dele Abdullahi, has been telling me more about this particular kidnapping and the reasons behind the spike in numbers in recent months.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. The kidnap was actually recent. She was kidnapped on the 27th of December 2023. She was picked from her home, which is within the hospital facility where she works. That's the National Health Center in Kaduna State, the northwest region of Nigeria. She was picked along with her husband and the nephew of the husband. But after some forms of negotiations, the husband has been released, but she and the nephew, they've been in incarceration for 8 months. We've been able to talk to her, but the bandits, the kidnappers are still making fresh demands, which has been difficult to be met by the family.
So have the family been paying ransom and they have yet to release her?
Yes, the family has paid something before. Remember I told you that the husband and the nephew of the husband were picked along with her. So something was actually paid at that time, for which the kidnappers released just the husband and insisted on more if you want her and the nephew released. So currently the negotiation is there, although the security agencies in Nigeria have promised that they are working in to see a way for her to be rescued.
Right, so she's been in captivity along with her nephew since December. It's 8 months, yes. More than 8 months now. Yes. Was this attack, do you think, random or was it targeted at her for professional or personal reasons?
We do not really have the data to corroborate specific attack based on professional reasons, but we will feel strongly that the attack was targeted at us specifically because there are so many warehouses within the same region, but only our house was attacked. She was picked along with the husband and the nephew. And they left the scene unscathed. So we feel the informant actually pointed her out specifically and that the attack was actually aimed at her, but we cannot state whether it's for professional reasons or maybe because they needed something else.
And I believe that doctors and medical professionals in Nigeria are being targeted more and more. In fact, it's cited as one of the main reasons why Nigerian medical professionals are leaving the country. Tell us a little bit more about that. How many people do you know that have been affected by this?
Well, we are beginning to see an increase in the target of medical professionals in Nigeria. Prior to this time, from 2022 to 2023, the total number of kidnapped cases that we had reported was barely 12. But between December 2023 until date, the number has grown to 32. We've had an increase in the total number of people that are kidnapped, with some even being kidnapped recurrently. In the last 1 month, there was the case of the kidnap of the doctor in Anambra. There was a case of the kidnap of the doctor in Akwa Ibom. There was a case of the kidnap of the doctor in Kogi State. There were 2 cases of kidnaps of doctors within Abuja. And there was still also the kidnap of the medical intern along with some medical students in Benue State. It has actually been increasing astronomically. And it's only a few things we are actually screaming out for. Yes, this ideology whereby the medical professionals are seen as soft targets for which they can easily get ransoms and get extra aids from them. Also, for some, based on reports after they were released, they are being used as healthcare providers within the chain of kidnappers.
Right. I was wondering why there would have been this spike in the kidnapping of medical professionals around the country, because at first I thought it might just have been in the north, but from what you're saying, it's not just the north. So do you think that it's because bandits need medical attention, and if they go to health facilities, they may draw attention to themselves, and at the same time, they see it as an opportunity to make money out of people whom they think will have money to pay their ransoms?
I will agree with you, because we've had reports of medical personnel being kidnapped to go render medical services. That is already facts that have been established. And yes, we have seen a soft target that will bring in more money to them. So all of these are actually put into place. And it's not just to the north. It's everywhere, all across the country. The only reason why it's really worrisome right now is in a place where we are trying to clamor for universal healthcare coverage, it's becoming very difficult for healthcare workers to go to the rural areas because of the fear of the insecurity in those places.
Is it particularly acute in rural areas? Are medical professionals more vulnerable to kidnap there?
The current statistics does not actually support that, but the distribution of security and the effect of security, if you look at generally, you cannot really say the attacker specifically in the rural regions. It cuts across both urban and rural regions right now.
And I imagine that you must be feeling particularly vulnerable. Do doctors now have to take special measures to try and protect themselves?
We currently are trying to retrain ourselves on how to become security conscious. But now with the kidnap and all the insecurity that you're seeing, we're putting a lot of other measures in place. And we're developing a protocol on what should be done in the case of a kidnap or a near kidnap, so as to create room for proper protection of all healthcare workers across the country.
How does it make you feel that you could be a target for kidnap?
Well, it's a fear factor we are living with as healthcare workers in Nigeria every day right now. It actually affects the dedication to the work. It affects the mental and physical health of most Nigerian healthcare workers. And what do I mean? The fear of being a target every day, or even hearing about your members being targeted, tends to drop your spirit as much as possible. And it's one of the few reasons why a lot of people just want to get out of the country and seek even where they are sure of security to a large extent.
So it's driving people wanting to leave the country and leave the profession perhaps as well?
Yes. You can imagine working in a department where a colleague of yours has been in captivity for 8 months. For the rest of you that are in that department, the only thing you're thinking about is just do what you the little you can do. And once you have an opportunity, you want to leave that particular vicinity so that you can go and get job elsewhere. As it stands right now, there are hospitals that will put up advertisements for employment, but because of insecurity within the state, most people don't want to go there. You have people trying to crowd over places where they are sure of security. And that is the very painful truth of the distribution of healthcare workers currently.
Let's talk about the ongoing doctor strike. Tell us a little bit about how it's going.
Well, the ongoing strike was instituted on 26th. It started midnight 26th. The aim of the strike is to raise awareness and to whip the federal government into place so that they can do their constitutional duty and help us secure the release of Dr. Fupola Gani. That is our one demand. There's a single demand activity right now. And what we are calling for is that Dr. Fupola Gani should be released unconditionally as possible.
So you basically want the government to go in and find her and bring her out. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. That is all we're asking for. We started, like I said, on the midnight 26th. And it's a 7-1 strike that should end on Sunday, where we will reevaluate activities of the government so far and then decide on a way forward. This strike action, a painful decision that we had to reach, because initially we had followed diplomatic ways of writing letters to the federal government with no response. We started increased media engagement, no response. We commenced center-based protests, no response, before we now reached this point of going on strike. We've had engagement with a lot of the government agencies since we started the strike, and we are hopeful that they can keep to their words and get her out as fast as possible.
That was Dr. Dele Abdullahi, the president of the Nigerian Doctors Association. Focus on Africa was put together by Bella Hassan and Alfonso Daniels here in London. Blessing Aderogba was on the case from Lagos. Chris Ablakwa was our technical producer. Sunita Nahar, the senior journalist in charge. Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi are our editors. I'm Audrey Brown, and we'll talk again next time.